Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
Lay your hands on the radio. Lay your hands on the radio there in the home.
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Blog Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Kansas
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. Something, there's always something interesting out there happening, isn't it?
And all you listeners out there, I'm your host, Mike Cadell. I send out sometimes early before the show, I send out little text messages and emails trying to promote the shows. And it's always interesting to see what responses I get. Almost always favorable. So I wanted to let Jim in Maine, or excuse me, Scott in Maine, Jim in Florida, Jennifer in Arizona, and thank you for responding. And I know you'll figure out a way to listen to the show. You don't have to call in. You can listen to it on your computer, or you can call in. And as a reminder to those listening on their computer, area code 646-716-8652. And Eileen in Beverly Hills, where are you? Aren't you listening? We like even people from Hollywood to listen in. Ed Asner, he's now gone. Ed Asner used to listen to it quite regularly. It was always impressive to see his number on the phone switchboard when he listened. And we miss Ed Asner. I do, personally. So we'll have another musical break later in in the next 15, 20 minutes. I'm going to discuss the Quincy Institute. The complete name is Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and I will discuss that as an introduction to tonight's main featured audio. And I hope you enjoy the show. It's going to be very interesting. We're going to try to be fair. We're getting a lot of guff, for lack of better terms, guff from people about what I've been linking on Facebook in terms of the war in Ukraine. And,
you know, how do you get
a good idea? How do you get
a good idea out of this horrible mess?
I mean, it really is a horrible mess. And, I'll tell you what I think and what I know after a couple songs here to try to get us in the mood for it. But you're all stars to me. I'll tell you that, every one of you listeners.
Some people in the whole wide world, that's me and the man in the moon.
Kansas. The chairman of the, well, bourgeois reformism, nonetheless, but still, it's possibly reformism. Is such a thing possible in Kansas? The chairperson of the Kansas Democratic Party recently sent out a fundraising letter, and it was quite interesting because her name is Vicki Hyatt, and contained a pretty quick summation of what voters are up against here, not beginning in November during the general election. No, it begins in the primary. Here are the key sentences of the, and it's not very long, not long at all. The Kansas, our state faces many hurdles as we prepare for 2022. Kansas Republicans hid a constitutional amendment to essentially outlaw abortion in Kansas on the primary ballot. Now, that's very interesting terminology, and it's accurate. The Republicans, the arch conservatives, because there are no moderate Republicans anymore, that will even come up to the surface. The Kansas Republicans hid a constitutional amendment, hid a constitutional amendment to essentially outlaw abortion in Kansas on the primary ballot. That means in August 2nd, a notorious time in the election cycle, the primaries. Now, a lot of people, you know, I was never a member of any party until 2016, and I never voted in primaries. Now, I probably should have, but I didn't because I didn't think about it. I didn't think about primaries. That was just a date on the calendar, and I just never did it until 2016. Then I started watching more closely how these things operate. And, of course, if you're a member of a party, you probably should, I guess, go and vote on a primary. But the primary usually has an astounding, shocking number of people who participate. Very few people participate in the primary ballot, which selects the main candidates. Well, no, not this time. Now there's a constitutional amendment included in the primary ballots. So when you go in to vote, you'll have the party that you, and you have to, and this is another thing, you more or less need to declare your party when you walk in. Now, you don't have to be a member of the party to vote in the primary. I've checked on this. You can participate in the primary, but you have to declare the party primary ballot you want. Even if you're an unaffiliated, that's the official term, the legal term, unaffiliated, also known as independent, which that's what I was until 2016. So go in to you declare your party or ballot, and you get your ballot, and on each of these primary ballots of either party is the constitutional amendment. It's called Value Them Both. That's the ridiculous terminology they use for amending the Constitution of the state of Kansas. Because the reason this happened is because the Kansas Supreme Court has followed the letter of the law on a federal level. Meaning, you know, they basically saw what they applied the federal guidelines on abortion. For the most part, well, it came down to a showdown in the Kansas State Supreme Court, and they declared many of these laws, these restrictive laws on abortion here in Kansas, is unconstitutional. Well, when it got push came to shove, amazingly, in my opinion, the state Supreme Court ruled that it was part of the autonomy. If you talk about a libertarian position, this is, if there was, they said the personal autonomy of the body and mind of a woman is inherently involved. Now, I'm not sure if that was the word exactly. As a matter of fact, I'm sure it wasn't. What the autonomy, I do know they use that word in their written majority opinion, of a woman's body and mind is it's in the Constitution. Now, it infers that. I mean, it doesn't say that. It does not say that in the Kansas Constitution, quote unquote, that a woman has autonomy over her body and mind. But they more or less said it did. Now, I don't know. They're the Supreme Court, and I'm glad they did do that. Well, this immediately enraged the ultra-conservatives that dominate the state government. And the legislature, dominated by the ultra-conservatives, the theocrats, the fanatics, they immediately came up with this idea. And because they're the supermajority in the state house, they came up with this horrible idea to put it in the primary ballot. This is a dirty little secret about how they play politics in Kansas. Because I really do believe that if it really was on the general election, it probably wouldn't pass. To basically, it acknowledges, of course, the unborn human, who I guess they must have a driver's license, civil rights, and citizenship papers to be declared. I'm being sarcastic. they're trying to outlaw the abortion procedure inherently within the Constitution. So they're going to amend the Constitution of the state of Kansas. Talk about overkill. I mean, plus you have Roe v. Wade. Now, backed up behind this
constitutional amendment to the state constitution
is a whole stack of unconstitutional laws that have been passed and vetoed.
But they're still out there ready to be enforced. I think they're in contention in court. But there would be a whole cascading effect of these laws going into effect
once,
if and when this amendment passed.
It's unbelievable, the ramifications.
Plus, on the federal level, you have a distinct possibility that Roe v. Wade will be overturned at the federal level this coming June.
That's June. Roe v. Wade may be overturned at the federal level. And then August.
June, July, August 2nd is the primary.
Now, we know
that what I call the fugitive slave,
the fugitive
female slave law
passed in Texas, which puts out a bounty on people who aid and abet or who have aid and abetted a woman or who, as a woman, has an abortion, even if they leave the state. And in Oklahoma,
just this last week or two,
they passed a law basically doing
almost the same thing, just a different flavor.
Missouri's anti-abortion law
was held up in court, but this is only a matter of time. What we're going to be facing, now, it could be, you know, say Kansas
people got their shit together. I mean, where Dr. George Tiller was murdered at. But who was there for decades and decades and decades, provided one of the few places you could get a third trimester abortion.
Yeah, very controversial. So-called late-term abortion. In the United States, the only spot in the map now, as it stands, is Colorado, where Dr. Ahern, who's he probably has an assistant now, I'm sure, Warren Ahern, does so-called late-term abortions. So that's the first sentence I read to you out of this letter. Essentially outlaw abortion. They hid a constitutional amendment to essentially outlaw abortion in Kansas on the primary ballot. Dirty tricks. Talk about dirty, dirty tricks. Additionally, Republicans drew up a vicious redistricting process. Now, they came up with three, that's from the letter by Vicky Hyatt, chairperson of the Kansas Democratic Party. Republicans drew up a vicious redistricting process, and it's focused on tearing apart communities of interest and diluting the minority vote and drawing Representative Sharice Davids out of her seat. Sharice Davids is a Native American member of the GLBT community, and very interesting. I mean, she's was a wrestler. She's cool, but she got elected, and it has been a thorn. Representative Sharice Davids, it has been a thorn in the ultra conservatives' skin since she was elected, and this is what they resorted to to try to drive her out. They're going to literally rewrite the map, gerrymander the districts, voting districts, and in order to get her out of office. This is unbelievable. Plus, they are running a man who I would could only call, his name is, he's currently the attorney general, state attorney general, named Derek Schmidt. And Derek Schmidt, largely not known to many voters, even in Kansas, is going to try to unseat Governor Kelly, Laura Kelly. And Governor, and he has a running chance at this. But the very sick part of this is that Derek Schmidt, Attorney General Derek Schmidt, is a clone, literally almost a genetically bio-engineered, politically engineered clone of the much-hated Governor Sam Brownback. So he is... he is running against Governor Kelly, and it's going to be an interesting... Talk about an all-front attack. I got to hand it to these people. I mean, they're smarter than Trump when it comes to trying to engineer elections. It's really sort of it's a bad situation. It's not really anything new. It's just much more desperate. it really is bad. I mean, what do you get when you have a one-party political process? I mean, is this a new thing? I don't know.
We like to go into a thing called Ain't No New Thing. It's based on the fact that white people continue to rip off black artists. They continue to steal their material, their styles, the very cultural elements that make the black artist the outstanding artist and master of music that he has been. And it ain't no new thing, to tell the truth, that these things are going on. We point out very expressly the fact that Stanley Crouch comments on his album, Ain't No Ambulances for No Niggas Tonight, that Chuck Berry was doing like a very heavy thing, a very heavy rock and roll thing, the king of rock and roll, as a matter of fact. But like white people couldn't dig having their daughters go to no shows and cream over no black man wiggling on the stage. So consequently, they invented Elvis Presley and let him do it. So we want to get into that, call it Ain't No New Thing, and talk about some people. Cultural rape and no geographical boundaries on white hate, and bizarre, scarcely concealed attempts to eliminate black generators of sun heat feeling. Ain't no new thing to see demon fangs curling out from under squeezed tight, too thin lips and leaping at jugular veins in burning black throats that either blow or sing or cry or scream. Ain't no new thing to see the bubbling envy flashing from the depths of soulless eyes as still another link with God is created. We used to having white people try to rob us. Why don't they try stealing some of this poverty? Ain't no new thing. Anything they can't understand, they try to destroy. Anything they can't understand, they try to control. In 1896, black men picked up brass instruments and began to evoke and conjure, entice and struggle with black spirits, rhythmic spirits of blues, work songs, gospel songs, freedom songs, and songs of love of Mother Night. Screaming rhythm, juju, rhythm, voodoo, rhythm, black magic that calls back to lost worlds and lost lifestyles, calling back to lost peace and peace of mind, calling back to Genesis, calling back to the drum, calling back to the drum, calling back to the first song chant that original man created. In 1896, this new spasm was called ass, but the ass would not be kicked. So it was copied in an attempt to control it, and then it was called jazz. We used to having black innovators copied and sent back to us. What about the Osmond Brothers? What about Elvis Presley? What about Tom Jones? We used to having people try to rob us. It ain't no new thing. They used the media to project their jazz idols. Tommy Dorsey and Jimmy Dorsey and Harry James and Benny Goodman, and I suppose someday Lawrence Welk will join that elite group. And then there was sweet Bessie Smith laying on the blood-soaked backseat of that broken-down jalopy with a tattered quilt wrapped around her shoulders, waiting for someone to come to her aid on a rainy Mississippi night, while a white hospital will not accept her right across the street. Ain't no new thing. Fats Navarro screaming through tormenting dreams, frustration ripping at his mind and bowels. Over 100 pounds melted from his frame as he battled that white powder mountain. Ain't no new thing. Cultural rape and no geographical boundaries on white hate hide black musicians away in funky, smoke-filled nightclubs. The Chitlin' Circuit saturate their worlds with 2-bit punks, washed-out, baggy-faced white whores, weasel-faced, yellow-skinned junkies, and cutthroat white managers, producers, agents, owners, and on and on and on. We used to having white people try to rob us. Ain't no new thing. We have dug his game. Charlie Parker will live on. John Coltrane will live on. Eric Dolphy will live on. Billie Holiday will live on. Jimi Hendrix and Clifford Brown and Lee Morgan will live on and on in the sunshine of their accomplishments, the glory of the dimensions that they added to our lives. We declare war on Eric Burdon. We discredit the talents of Janis Joplin and Rare Earth. We urge that the next blue-eyed soul group include Melvin Laird, Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, and Spearhead Agnew, and be called As the Stomach Turns. We urge that the album John Wayne Sings the Blues be released. Release the album J. Edgar Hoover Sings James Brown. Release the album Wallace and Maddox Sing Sam and Dave. Why not? We hear Tony the Tiger sing, "Right on, Tiger." We heard Nixon talking about power to the people. It ain't no new thing. 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 America is always the same old shit.
Gil Scott Heron.
We want to do a poem for one of our unfavorite people, who's now the head of the Nixon campaign. He was formerly the attorney general named John Mitchell. Nixon's campaign seems to be out, you know, getting off on a rather hip foot after his trip to China in the name of peace, while they were killing people right across the street, so to speak, in North and South Vietnam. But No Knock, the law in particular, was allegedly legislated for black people rather than, you know, for their destruction. And it means simply that authorities and members of the police force no longer have to knock on your door before entering. They can now knock your door down. It's No Knock. It to me, I must admit, but just for the record, you were talking shit. Long rap about No Knock being legislated for the people you've always hated in this hellhole that we call home. No Knock, the man will say, to keep that man from beating his wife. No knock, the man will say, to protect people from themselves. No knocking, head rocking, into shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. No knock. No knocked on my brother Fred Hampton, bullet holes all over the place. No knocked on my brother Michael Harrison, jammed a shotgun against his skull. For my protection, who's gonna protect me from you? The likes of you, the nerve of you, to talk that shit face to face, your tomato face deadpan, your deadpan deadening another freedom plan. No knocking, head rocking, into shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. But if you're wise, no knocker, you'll tell your no-knocking lackeys, ha, no knock on my brother's head, no knock on my sister's head, no knock on my brother's head, no knock on my sister's head, and double lock your door, because soon someone may be no-knocking, ha, ha, for you. No knock, to be slipped into John Mitchell's suggestion box.
Oh, man, you can't beat that. And that's old stuff. That's some old stuff of Gil Scott. He's gone now, but boy, some of that. I forgot about no-knock warrants until Black Lives Matter. Yeah, I was like, they're still doing that? I can't believe it. Oh, what was the woman, Breonna Taylor, I think, or what was her name? The woman, the black woman that was gunned down, literally in getting up out of her bed to answer a no-knock warrant. Unbelievable. And the cops largely get away with it, except for I think one cop is going to stand trial over it. Oh, man, it's unbelievable. But, you know, what the struggle takes us through. If you really want to know what's going on besides Ukraine in the world, you got to listen to the United Nations radio. At least where the hot spots, where the most people are dying of starvation, where the most people are being beat up. United Nations Radio comes in and news in brief. It's less than 5 minutes, and it gives you a good one. That's why I play it every day of the week when I'm on, because it gives you a really good bird's eye view of it. And also, by the way, if you want to get a bird's eye view of what's going on in Israel and Palestine, you really ought to send me an email, and the email address is real easy. It's long, but it's easy. It's all one word, bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. I got a hot connection who really keeps me tuned in on what's going down on the other side of the walls in Palestine. And I get it almost every other day, if not every day. And I'll be happy to recommend you to the email list. But first you have to send me an email. It's Blue Barn News Central, all one word, bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. And I'll be happy to see if the person who administers the list will accept you to get the emails. They're very valuable emails, and I read every one of them and cross-post them. Not all of them, because there are a lot of them, but if you really want to know the hot spot in the world that's going down, it's pretty nasty in Palestine, and they're getting away with it because all the news, I think the popular cliche is, all the oxygen is being sucked by the Ukraine civil war. That's what some have called it, a special military operation. That's what Putin calls it, and invasion, according to the Ukrainian nationalists. Take whatever you want. It's sucking all the oxygen. There's a lot of things going on in the world besides Ukraine. Of course, the neoliberals and the neocons are sucking all the oxygen out and killing news as we know it today. The Quincy Institute, The Quincy Institute was
started,
and I'm just telling you this because it's a fact, it's true, with seed money,
now by billionaires, both
two billionaires, probably two of the most
hated billionaires,
at least up until,
I don't know, 2012
or 2016, two of the most hated billionaires in the world. And this is
what I remember, and I may be wrong on the numbers, but it's roughly
Charles Koch of Koch Industries in Wichita, the billionaires who are super donors, they network, and you know who the Koch brothers are. Well, David is dead. He lived in New York anyhow, so he didn't really matter as a billionaire to me, but he's gone, but Charles remains. Or Chucky, as he likes to be called, Chucky. Chucky Koch is still around. And he, and, are you ready for this? George Soros. No kidding. George Soros and Charles Koch, Chucky, each plopped down, I think it was $100,000 each. Now, it may have been more. I don't know. It doesn't matter. The point is they both threw down to start the Quincy Institute. They did it wasn't too many years ago. I probably should have got the date. It was really strange because I'll tell you what, I got a job application by email. No kidding. I'm not kidding. This is true. At the time, and it was an application for me to apply. I should have applied. I did not think about it. I thought, wait a minute, who is this? And I did some research, and it's in the news, yes. The Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft was started, at least seed funded, by both Soros and Koch. Now, I think they got some sort of,
they can't get involved in it.
But they started it. And the Quincy Institute... has slowly,
over the last couple of years, been accumulating
the talent, the writers, the thinkers, the cred, the street cred, to start talking about war. They have a fantastic newsletter. Embedded is a link in the
today's program on the Blog Talk Radio Network.
It's under Voice of Kansas, listeners. A lot of people can't find my program because it's in the
Blog Talk Radio Network, and you just put in the search Voice of Kansas,
and that'll take you to it. But embedded in
the program summary tonight
is a link where you can subscribe to their free e-newsletter,
and it's really good. Good stuff. It really is.
And it's across the spectrum. It's not right or left. It's a little. It's really towards responsible statecraft. And they picked some of the best
to contribute to their new e-newsletter.
And it's well worth it.
Your time to check out. I can't believe I'm saying this, but it's the truth.
And actually,
maybe some of the billionaires, at least George Soros and
Charles Koch,
Chucky, don't want to see the planet incinerated. There may be
something to that. Of course,
none of them want to admit that it can spin out of control at any minute.
And, yes, deep fry the planet, or deep fry the planet with climate change. Professor Noam Chomsky repeatedly warns us that if we don't start, if we don't start doing this quick, the tipping points are just a few years away, literally 2-3, at most 5 years away. You could see it. Come on, you could see. Come on, you could see it. And the bizarre weather patterns. We had many tornadoes in Kansas, nearly as many in the last 3 or 4 years. And it seems to be migrating more towards the southeast part of the country. So, I mean, there's definitely some stuff, right? So it's definitely.
So the Quincy Institute...
started out humble origins,
well-funded, became a Washington think tank,
It's now more and more appearing on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, to her credit. And it's getting out there for a change. Catherine Vandehool, who is a head honcho at The Nation magazine, contributes to it regularly. And the president of the Quincy Institute is a guy named Andrew Bacevich. And Andrew Bacevich, Mr. Bacevich, as president, is trying to – he's the father of – I think his son was killed in, I think, Afghanistan or Iraq. And he's sort of what I call a gold star dad. And he comes from a military background himself. Now, then he started teaching and writing, and that's where he got his street cred about opposing war. So it's a very interesting mix of people, both right and left, who have come around the Quincy Institute. Now, if you haven't put it together, I'll help you. They picked the name the Quincy Institute. I remember this at the founding of the where they sent me the job application. I should have filled it out. It's after John Quincy Adams, and it's because Quincy Adams, he was a pretty he was way back there, and he was against these foreign wars, and so. I think it's sort of interesting that this institute has grown in the last 3-5 years. It hasn't been very long. And I'm going to give you this. It's with a guy from The Realist. He's another smart guy. And this is their podcast, their recent podcast from the Quincy Institute.
Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. The war in Ukraine, so far, is our subject this hour. The angle of observation is realist, so-called. It's a way of thinking about world affairs that is founded on the vital interest of nation states like security and survival in an often tragic arena of rise and fall competition. Steve Walt from the Kennedy School at Harvard is among the most respected and quoted of realists. He's been coaching us in conversation for 20 years, since George W. Bush prepared to invade Iraq. Not in the U.S. interest, Steve Walt and the realists declared flatly. The war in Ukraine has been more complicated. Not in Russia's interest or Putin's, Steve Walt thought, before it happened. Since then, the question has been whether realist thinking ever caught up with what Putin was doing and why. Was he really feeling threatened by NATO's expansion toward Russia? Was Putin bent on a new Slavic empire? Was he out of touch with reality? Steve, what if the meaning of this war is in two big surprises? First, the courage, cohesion, the pride of the Ukrainian people, but also the psychopathic cruelty of Putin, of course, but men lost in the frenzy of war.
I don't think those are the defining features of the war. Certainly the heroism and nationalism, national pride being shown by the Ukrainians is remarkable. It was not fully anticipated by the Russians at all. I think that was a huge surprise to them. It shouldn't be a complete surprise to us, of course, because the United States had been arming and training Ukraine for a number of years now, and we were aware that, they were trying to create the capabilities to defend their independence if necessary. I also don't think the cruelty that we're seeing is going to be a defining feature because, sadly, this is not uncommon. This is something that happens frequently in wars, and particularly in wars where major powers think their vital interests are at stake. It's deplorable. It ought to be condemned. If it were possible to hold those responsible accountable, we should try to do that. But that's not the only thing that's going on here. That shouldn't be something that does surprise us.
It's obvious to us that Putin lost his vicious war, but will we ever conclude that somebody won it?
it's, I think, too early to declare, you know, sort of winners and losers. There's no question that if Putin expected a swift and rapid victory here, then that goal is not going to be achieved. And certainly, I think he didn't anticipate the costs, both the military costs he has paid and the economic costs that have been imposed by sanctions. I think in those cases, there was clearly a miscalculation. But on the other hand, the end game of this war could end up being a Ukraine that is permanently neutral. Russian control over Crimea and portions of the east, possibly including a land bridge connecting the Donbas to Crimea, and some other understandings about minority rights, which Putin has long declared he was serious about. So the cost may be much greater. The damage to Ukraine is tragic. But at the end of this, he may look back and say, I paid a larger price than I expected, but I still think it was worth it. I'm not suggesting that that justifies what he did at all, but it's, I think, too early to say that this is a massive defeat for Russia in the short to medium term. I think one can talk then about what the longer term consequences for Russia may be, and I think those are likely to be quite negative.
I'm still wondering who won the argument about this war and its purpose. From my standpoint, it's been a war to discredit war itself, to discount the incredible investment we put into weaponry. The alternative, as you say, was to neutralize Ukraine on the model of Austria during the Cold War. Some significant piece of our government, seemed to me, wanted to risk flipping Ukraine to the West. Many Ukrainians did too, and Putin went nuts. And here we are.
I think you want to avoid phrases like went nuts. And yes, I agree with you. I think that we were quite cavalier. And going back many years now in thinking that we could begin expanding NATO, declare that that was going to be an open-ended process, that there was essentially no limit to it as well, ignored repeated Russian objections, including by politicians other than Vladimir Putin, as to what we were doing. And then, of course, ignoring the very strong Russian response in both 2008 and again in 2014 when we began trying to bring Ukraine and Georgia into the so-called Western fold. But we blindly assumed, and it wasn't just Americans, we blindly assumed that Russia would never do anything about this. They were too weak. Ultimately, we could deter them. You know, the Germans were perfectly willing to keep buying Russian energy because they never thought this would actually turn into something really serious. And in that sense, I think we did not take the possibility seriously that Russia would take the kind of action that they have now done. That was naive on our part. That doesn't justify in any way what Russia has done. But if you don't understand why it happened, right, you're not likely to understand, you know, both how to get out of it and what mistakes we may have made in the past.
But surely there are people, lots of them, who say now it wasn't about his feeling insecure at NATO's advance. It was some larger plan or some larger dream he had of a greater Russia, a Slavic empire. I mean, I'm not sure we've got the cause straight yet.
Well, I think there is a number of things going on here. I think the evidence that NATO enlargement was part of what produced this is really overwhelming, and it makes logical sense, right? The world's most powerful military alliance keeps moving closer and closer to Russian territory. There have been various acts of political instability or upheaval that have removed autocratic governments, the so-called color revolutions. And Russia may exaggerate the degree to which we were involved in instigating or supporting those sorts of things. But if you're an autocratic government, you have to worry when that starts happening nearby. It's often said now in the West that Putin wasn't really worried about NATO enlargement, wasn't worried about a military attack. He was worried about being overthrown. Well, those two things are related, that if we keep moving democracies closer and closer to Russia, including into places that are connected to Russia historically, that's going to be seen as part of a broader campaign to gradually impose or encourage a Western-style overthrow in Moscow. We might think that would be a wonderful thing if it happened, but you could understand why a Russian leader, particularly an autocrat, might regard that as threatening. One final point here that is often forgotten, right? There was a nuclear dimension to this. You know, we had talked for a long time about putting missile defenses in Eastern Europe and kept claiming that they were directed at Iran. They really weren't directed at Russia. But of course, the Russians were always worried about our technological superiority and the possibility that we might be getting some kind of first strike capability. And if that sounds crazy, let's just remember that back in the 1970s and 1980s, Americans worried a lot about whether Russia was going to get a first strike capability. Top U.S. officials, people like Richard Pipes, Paul Nitze, published articles warning about a Russian first strike capability. Well, if we can worry about that in the old Cold War days, Russia, much weaker economically, technologically falling behind the West in a variety of ways, was worried about that too. So I think there was a legitimate set of security concerns animating what Putin was doing, even if, of course, the response to those security concerns was both immoral, illegal, wrong, and ultimately, I think, counterproductive.
2 weeks ago, we marked the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s moral denunciation of the war in Vietnam. And I wondered, adding moral to realism would have kept us out of Vietnam, simply putting the interests of the Vietnamese people ahead of the overrated interests of states, and would have been well out of Southeast Asia. How is moral realism, or pragmatic realism, realism that works, how's that as an improvement on the realist bumper sticker?
That's a great question. And, you know, realists are often accused of being either immoral or amoral, and I think it's an unfair charge. I think realists are very mindful of the tragic nature of politics, the unpredictability of war itself, the destructive qualities of war. So while we recognize that war is always possible, we're also, I think, well aware of the consequences, and therefore that you should not be waging them for anything other than absolutely vital interests, not for idealistic reasons, not on a whim, not as part of some larger political crusade, particularly in parts of the world that you don't understand very well.
The difference, though, Steve, is that the MLK version puts the moral question first, maybe first, second, third, and fourth, and the strategic, so-called, I mean, saving South Vietnam from the government they would have elected under Ho Chi Minh, that was confused with a great strategic interest, and it wasn't.
That's correct. But the problem with putting morality first is that immediately inclines you or puts you on the slippery slope to sort of wars to eliminate evil, to unlimited wars, to wars that are not fought for narrow national interests, narrow security reasons, but rather wars to eradicate whoever you think the problem is. So to get it back to Ukraine, can we end this war? Well, it's going to be very difficult to compromise now. If Joe Biden or Zelensky were to propose a peace deal that gave Russia anything, that made any concession to Russian concerns, they would face a firestorm of criticism for compromising with this evil government. So I think what King is suggesting is correct. One ought to have the moral concern front and center, but one ought to recognize that sometimes putting that front and center may incline you to the kind of crusading that gets millions of people killed. You're bringing up Vietnam is actually quite an interesting illustration of this. You know, we're rightly very condemning of Vladimir Putin launching a war to try and determine Ukraine's geopolitical alignment. The United States in the 1960s and 1970s fought a war in Indochina to essentially try to determine South Vietnam's geopolitical alignment, to prevent it from being unified by North Vietnam becoming part of the communist world. Of course, we were willing to spend the lives of over 50,000 Americans and the lives of several million people in Indochina to try and shape right. South Vietnam's geopolitical alignment. Now, do you think John F. Kennedy was irrational? Was wild-eyed? Was crazy? Was Lyndon Johnson crazy, irrational? Was Richard Nixon? Well, I don't think any of those adjectives apply to those. They were wrong. They were misguided. They were maybe misinformed in a variety of ways. But you wouldn't want to characterize them as sort of crazy, paranoid, and certainly not as, you know, wild-eyed expansionists seeking to conquer all of Southeast Asia. They were driven by a set of concerns about what losing Vietnam might mean for America's overall security and geopolitical position. And I might add, We did a lot of really horrific things in that war, using napalm, Agent Orange, etc. That was the United States, the land of the free. I'm perfectly comfortable condemning what Russia is doing in Ukraine. It ought to be condemned, but we ought to recognize that it's not a unique event historically and retain a certain level of humility about it, too.
Coming up, the real Joe Biden, strategist, commander, and commentator-in-chief. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Our guest, Steve Walt, is a capital R realist in the study of international relations. The emphasis is on strategic needs, nation by nation. The first rule of realism might be not to neglect your core interests or your neighbors without expecting a fight or risking a tragedy. In the Ukraine case, the question is out there, do realists undervalue human factors like the spirit among Ukrainians and their president, Zelensky, but also the gangster element in Vladimir Putin?
I don't think so. I mean, realism doesn't put a lot of emphasis on the role of individuals. It's more of a theory about sort of the basic nature of world politics. And certainly individuals have mattered here. Certainly Zelensky's remarkable abilities to rise to an occasion and appeal to the sympathies and support of the world to rally his own people. I do think realists have a pretty high appreciation for nationalism as a powerful force in world affairs, reluctance of people to live under others' thumbs. I think that's one of the reasons we were wary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, that we didn't know what we were getting into, and we were not going to be greeted as liberators by everyone in Iraq. I think that same appreciation has made us skeptical about the long American campaign in Afghanistan. So the fact that the Ukrainians did not want to be ruled by Moscow doesn't really surprise us, even though the sort of vigor of the response and the effectiveness of the response, I think, has surprised almost everyone. And, of course, the role of inspirational leaders such as Zelensky.
Pick up on the surprises, Steve Walt. What has surprised the realists most, including the apparent incompetence of the Russian military, tanks tipped over onto their turrets? A screw-up with what effect?
Well, to be perfectly candid, I did not expect a war to break out until 2-3 weeks before it actually did. I thought, in part, there would be a much more serious effort at diplomacy, a much more serious negotiation. And there was a lot of talks and various exchanges, but the United States and NATO never took Ukrainian membership off the table or suggested that was negotiable. And if you believe that was the principal sticking point for Vladimir Putin, then, you know, I think at that point the war did in fact become inevitable. I think many realists were not that surprised by the poor performance of the Russian military because, you know, there's a long history, I think, of America exaggerating Russian military capabilities sort of for threat inflation purposes. They fought worse than I would have expected, but I didn't expect a lightning-like operation. So I guess I'm only slightly surprised by that. Like everyone else, I think I've been surprised by the rapid and vigorous Western response, and especially the reaction of, say, Germany. But I shouldn't have been. That was just a blunder on my part, because, of course, it's entirely consistent with the realist view that states, you know, the balances of power operate, that when states see a major threat emerging or a new threat or they have to reevaluate a threat, they tend to balance against it. They don't jump on the bandwagon and join forces with the threatening power. They unify to contain its effects. And that's precisely what we're seeing happen with NATO in a way that I think many people would have underestimated beforehand.
What surprised me, among other things, is how precisely the U.S. military intelligence can read the mind of the Russian military people, even their talk to each other.
This is something you don't see people talk about very much, but I think, first of all, this is a success story for American intelligence, which has had some black eyes over the last 20 or 30 years, but, you know, they saw what was happening, they interpreted it properly, they correctly challenged skepticism elsewhere in Europe that Russia was really serious about all of this. We don't know exactly how much electronic surveillance was involved in this, you know, how deeply we may have penetrated into various
parts of the Soviet communications infrastructure. So, you know, that's obviously not going to be revealed openly because we may still want to rely upon those capabilities. But yes, in this case, the intelligence community and the Biden administration had a pretty accurate read on certainly the potential for Russian military action and also the likelihood that it might happen.
Steve, what have we seen of the real Joe Biden of significance here? I mean, there was the famous 9-word Freudian slip, it seemed. He said, for God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. And, of course, Putin took it as confirmation of what this war was all about, that the West is still trying to break Russia down and, of course, get rid of him. I'm also wondering if Biden revealed a sort of unipolar American mentality that has not read the recent headlines. I mean, do we still have another agenda for a world that seems pretty well fed up with our interventions?
I'm inclined to agree with that. I mean, I don't think the Biden administration has a sort of well-formulated plan for regime change in Russia. You know, it might be something they might wish for, but I don't think there's an active campaign underway to try and bring the Russian government down even now. I do think that comment by Biden that, you know, this man must go does reflect a certain sort of moralistic tendency in American foreign policy that, you know, we can decide who the good leaders are, who the bad leaders are, and name them and shame them and eventually drive them out of power. Barack Obama did the same thing when he said, you know, Assad must go in Syria. And that may have been a, you know, morally desirable outcome, but it was not something that we could bring about and, you know, probably got in the way of trying to stop that war before it had really expanded to the tragedy that it became. In a sense, Joe Biden is a very traditional mainstream view forged in, you know, the Cold War and the immediate aftermath of the United States as the embodiment, the leader, the evangelist for the so-called liberal world order. And the statements like that are, I think, entirely consistent with that worldview. Whether or not that worldview is really going to be appropriate for the world we're heading into, I think, is a really interesting question.
But it sounds uncorrected by the retrospect on the Iraq War, for which he voted. I mean, what has he learned, do you suppose?
You could argue, of course, he did learn a number of things. Right? He, I think, was early on a skeptic about the American effort to create a sort of Western-style democracy in Afghanistan. And, you know, from very early in the Obama administration, he was the voice saying, you know, that's beyond our means. We should focus on counterterrorism and, you know, light footprint. And he then delivered on that, you know, many years later when he became president and took us out of Afghanistan. So I think he has learned, you know, that our ability to do social engineering in the developing world, especially with military force, is quite limited, maybe non-existent. But Europe, in a sense, is different. I think he does sort of buy into the, you know, this is the free world. These are our fellow democracies. He made that very clear in the campaign that he was going to restore ties to the members of NATO who had had their feathers ruffled and worse by Donald Trump. He had been a backer of Ukraine all along. Right? He was the principal interlocutor in the Obama administration with the Ukraine government. Right. And so, you know, I think he was fully on board with this idea of trying to nurture Ukraine as a closer American partner over time. Certainly never skeptical about the idea that maybe someday Ukraine should be part of NATO. You know, remember that pledge was made in 2008 and the Obama administration and the Trump administration never took that pledge away. And I think Biden was fully on board with that. In that sense, the sort of, you know, there's two worlds, there's a free world and there's a non-free world, and our principal partners are in Europe, the fellow democracies. I think that's very much part of Biden's worldview. And when that seems to be jeopardized by Russian actions, and particularly by brutal Russian actions, it's really easy for him to go in front of a microphone and say something like what he said.
Hmm. More surprising to me is that Victoria Nuland, sort of a point person for intervention and regime change, specifically in the land of the color revolutions, is the number four person in his State Department.
Certainly it's evidence that a point that many of us have made before, that doesn't matter how wrong you've been in the past, you can still rise to new positions of authority in the U.S. government. And I think whatever her many virtues may be, she is also a U.S. official who played a key role back in 2014 in the events that eventually led to the loss of Crimea and the fomenting of an active war in the eastern provinces in Ukraine. And, you know, may have been done with the best of intentions, but the outcome of this was, I think, quite damaging to Ukraine. And obviously to Russian-American relations as well. And again, it's one of the things that has led us to the situation we are in today.
What does it tell us, 6 weeks into the war, that China has awarded a sort of critical victory to Putin and to Russia? But also, what should Americans conclude from the pretty stark post-Ukraine alignment of giant nations? They used to be called the BRICS, Brazil, China, India, Iran, others, with Russia, not with America and Europe. Whoever thought that the BRICS would be a Guinness?
Let me come back to that one in a second. I mean, you started with the question of China, and I think China's is a really interesting example here. You could argue that China had missed an extraordinary opportunity here, that this was a moment when China could have adopted a different position and said, look, this is a fight among Western powers, including Russia, who can't manage their own affairs, who are constantly getting into these quarrels, real tragedy. We here in the East, you know, we have a different way of dealing with others. We're peaceful. We don't start wars. We don't fight in wars. We believe in state sovereignty, et cetera. So we will mediate this. We have good ties with Moscow. We have growing ties with Europe. Let us settle this. We want to come in, you know, like Teddy Roosevelt after the Russo-Japanese War and say, we'll settle this one, we'll mediate. And that, I think, would have been a remarkable diplomatic move, particularly if they'd been able to do so successfully.
If China had been able to do it, or we had been able to engineer it?
If China had offered to mediate this and settle it and been able to pull it off, that would have been, you know, an extraordinary statement about, you know, this being the Chinese century. You don't want to follow America because it only gets you into trouble. You don't want to follow Russia, that gets you into trouble. You want to follow our approach to world policy. They didn't do that, but it seems to me that might have been a missed opportunity. From Beijing's point of view, this war is, of course, a distraction from matters in Asia and the East. It has occupied all sorts of bandwidth in the United States and in Europe, which means there's less focus on what's happening in Asia. And secondly, Putin may end up succeeding, not in getting the outcome he may have initially hoped for, certainly at a price far greater than he expected to pay. But in terms of the core objectives of preventing Ukraine from ever becoming part of NATO and retaining control over the Russian-speaking areas in the East and Crimea, he may end up with that outcome. And then the final point here is that, you know, in some sense, over the last 5-6 years, Xi Jinping has been betting more on Russia. That partnership has gotten deeper. I think they've met over 30 times in this period. And it's very hard for Xi Jinping ever to admit he's wrong about anything. And for him to have adopted a different course at this point, to have been actively critical, to have worked against Russia, or maybe even to offer to mediate, would have been an acknowledgement that he'd made a bad bet.
I'd love to hear your little bit of advice to Xi Jinping. You've made a mistake here, sir. Time to reconsider.
I think Xi Jinping has made a number of mistakes, and you could argue that the major powers are now in a relentless competition to see which one can make the most mistakes. Certainly over the past 25 years, the United States has made a number of really catastrophic blunders. We're still okay. We are a big and powerful and very secure country, so we may survive all of these mistakes, but we've certainly hurt ourselves. I think in the last 5 to 10 years, China has been gradually moving away from the strategy that had been working very effectively, the sort of peaceful rise, build up power and strength and wealth at home, remain on good terms with neighbors as much as possible, and adopting a much more belligerent, ambitious, openly revisionist rhetoric in a variety of ways, and had achieved the predictable reaction of alarming many countries in Asia, alarming countries in Europe who, you know, 5 to 10 years ago were perfectly happy to do business with China as much as they possibly could, alarming some of the countries in Africa with whom they were trying to court through the Belt and Road Initiative. The advice I'd give Xi Jinping is, you know, cool your jets a little bit and start trying to manage relations and others in ways that are not as threatening to them. And of course, as I said before, a slightly different policy towards Ukraine, I think, would have yielded big diplomatic benefits. Your other part of this question was, well, what about the rest of the world, the so-called BRICS?
Yeah.
The fact that India did not support it, abstained on the General Assembly resolution condemning the invasion, as did South Africa, as did a number of other countries in Asia, as did Bolivia. Much of the rest of the world, particularly in the global south, does not gravitate towards our framing of this as, you know, the free world versus dictatorship, the free world versus autocracy. That's sometimes because some of these governments are autocracies, not true of South Africa and India, by the way. But the way in which we see this conflict is not the way it is seen by others, particularly countries that have been the object of European or American military action in the past. The second thing here, of course, is just to remember, and this is, you know, back to realism 101, is that other countries have their own interests, and they have to calculate them very carefully. So Israel has been very careful about how it has responded to this. It voted for the General Assembly resolution, but it has not been openly condemning Russia. They've been keeping those ties open. It's not participating in the economic sanctions. And that's in part because they have a complicated relationship with Russia. They need to be able to cooperate with Russia regarding the ongoing fighting in Syria, things like that. So Israel's pursuing its own national interests as it perceives them. Same is true of India. India is a democracy, has been moving closer to the United States in recent years, but India also gets a substantial amount of its military hardware from Russia, is dependent upon them for, you know, spare parts and resupply, things like that. And so India has adopted a much more nuanced approach toward the fighting in Ukraine than you might have expected otherwise. And I think that's true of many other countries as well.
But you're making me wonder, who could we count on in the world in general? And why not Israel or India, for example, not a party to the fight, but to simply speak up on the moral issue of naked aggression, illegal aggression, and utter brutality in things like the train station bombing?
Again, because there are possible strategic consequences in both of those cases for taking a really openly confrontational approach towards what Russia is doing.
I mean, just simple calling murder, murder. And I don't mean to be too high horse about it, but simply keeping up with the moral score before the whole world.
Countries often are more inclined to engage in, you know, moral condemnation when they don't think there's any negative consequences for doing so. That's true of us in a number of cases. To pick another contemporary example, the United States is still providing various forms of tacit support for Saudi Arabia, which is waging a war in Yemen.
Yeah, we've talked about it, right.
Right. Up until recently, you'd argue that that was the greatest humanitarian tragedy on the planet, up until Ukraine. And yes, American officials have occasionally made sort of mildly critical comments at various points, but when push has come to shove, they have declined to end our relationship or put any significant pressure on Saudi Arabia because we thought the consequences would be greater than the benefits. I'm not defending this, but I do find this a pretty familiar behavior in world politics.
Is there a case for a war crimes trial in these on-camera brutal inhumanity of the Russian war? Is there any way to have another Nuremberg trial?
That's very unlikely. There is certainly a case for it, and it's worth noting that the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has already opened an investigation into possible war crimes, and I think that's entirely appropriate. The difficulty, of course, is that we don't have a mechanism to put Putin or Russian officials, you know, in the dock. Let's remember that the United States is not even a party to the Rome Convention that creates the International Criminal Court. We have a rather selective approach to that particular institution. But in order to face prosecution by the International Criminal Court or to be put in the dock at some kind of Nuremberg-like tribunal, you have to be removed from power. Either you're militarily defeated and the victors take over, or you're overthrown by your own government and then they give you up. Those are the only people who have been prosecuted by these various bodies. So it's appealing to many of us that it would be nice to hold the parties responsible, including, by the way, any Ukrainians who might have been guilty of war crimes, because they usually occur on both sides in the fighting. But holding people who've conducted war crimes accountable is something that we definitely ought to try and do. The problem is we lack the mechanisms to do it in most circumstances. And if I had to bet, I would say that's likely to be the case here as well.
Coming up, the quest for ideas, meanings, effects yet to come out of this war in Ukraine. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with Steve Walt, the Harvard Scholar of International Relations. I'm fascinated by all the wise folk online, on the air, trying to frame the significance of this whole war. Adam Tooze, for example. The question posed by Vladimir Putin's invasion, says Adam Tooze, is whether, in this fundamental sense, the spell of the end of history has ended. The triumph of social democracy and mixed economies has finally been broken. Has history restarted in a tragic key, he asks, as President Macron recently put it. Are we back on the old course of military history, making the crucial decisions by war?
I think that's, you know, probably pretty close to being right. And my guess is when we look back on this, you know, 30, 40 years hence, we will see this not so much as a game changer in the sense that it wasn't that things were moving in one direction and this event happened and it headed back in another direction. What I tend to see the Ukraine war as the acceleration of a number of trends that were already underway, the reemergence of great power competition, the backsliding against democracy, the tendency towards deglobalization that had already begun, partly due to COVID, partly due to Trump's trade war, partly due to a number of forces elsewhere, people being more concerned, for example, about China's economic role and wanting to distance themselves in various ways. So that was all underway before the war happened. And this war, of course, has now reinforced all of those developments. I think we will look back on the period, you know, sort of 1993, 2016, maybe 2020, as this unusual interregnum. It was the unipolar era, and it was an interregnum in which great powers weren't at odds with each other directly. Not in a big way. You know, we fought wars. We fought some stupid wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we weren't fighting against other great powers. China stayed out of those wars. Russia stayed out of those wars. No other medium powers really got involved. And now what we're seeing is a war where the United States and another great power, a much weaker great power, but another great power, are on opposite sides. We are not directly fighting in the war, but we are actively engaged in helping the Ukrainians fight this war. We are on opposite sides in a big way, and we haven't seen that situation in, you know, 25, 30 years, and I think that is the world we are headed into.
I'm sure you read Steve Kutkin, an amazingly prolific historian of Russia, especially under Stalin. Comment on his notion in Foreign Affairs the other day that the old Cold War never really stopped, and it's back in a big way with new trimmings. For the first time in history, he says, China and the United States are great powers simultaneously. China is the main adversary. Russia is China's sidekick. Is that where we are?
I think that's right. Steve Kutkin is a brilliant historian, one of the best in the world, and I think he's got this one basically 100% right. And that has an implication to it. One is that we should not get so distracted by what's happening in Ukraine and so oriented towards that problem that we neglect what is happening in other parts of the world. Again, the longer term, and we shouldn't neglect what needs to be done here in the United States if the next 30 or 40 years is primarily about a competition with China. I think one of the long-term consequences of this, of course, is that Russia will continue to get weaker in relative terms. right? We're seeing more of a brain drain away from Russia. Russia is not going to go back to business as usual with the rest of the world when this is all settled, not anytime soon. So Russia's ability to continue to compete economically with the rest of the world, I think, is going to simply decline. And as we gradually, I hope, wean ourselves also off of fossil fuels, that's going to diminish one of Russia's remaining assets. So yes, it'll be China's sidekick, but a sidekick of declining value over time. China versus the United States, or the rivalry there, is going to be the more important competition, and that's primarily a competition for influence in Asia and some other places, but primarily in Asia. And it's also a competition for the commanding heights of the world economy and the commanding heights of sort of science and technology and the digital world and all of that. And that's something you don't win by seizing territory, by grabbing chunks of land. You win that one in universities, you win that one in industry, you win that one in international organizations that are setting the digital standards that the world is going to operate by. And if we turn the war in Ukraine into the most important fulcrum of the 21st century, which I don't believe it is, we're going to neglect those other issues and wake up in 2030, 2040, 2050, realizing that we missed what the really big issue was.
Another example of the punditry, the framing of this war as the opening around of an endless war between democracy and autocracy. Tom Friedman in the Times, for example, Frank Fukuyama and others say that that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, and it's the struggle of the 21st century.
This is a framework, of course, that Americans are very comfortable with, to view the world solely through this sort of ideological lens, the free world versus the non-free world. It goes back to, you know, the founding fathers in some respects. Certainly it's part of Woodrow Wilson, and this idea that you know, spreading democracy around the world is really our mission, very much the way we framed the Cold War as well. I personally am delighted, thrilled, very grateful that I live in a society where liberal values are still widely respected. But I don't think it's a particularly useful way of framing how American foreign policy is going to be conducted. First of all, as you mentioned before, many parts of the world, this just doesn't resonate with them. It's not the way they think about the problem. Secondly, it exposes us constantly to trade-offs and charges of hypocrisy. Wait a second, you're supposed to be in favor of democracy over autocracies, and look at all your friends who happen to be autocratic, and you never seem to criticize them as well. And finally, I think it has encouraged the belief that we could make ourselves more secure by essentially crusading, by trying to export our model everywhere we could. And that has not worked particularly well over the last 15 or 20 years. But also it virtually guarantees that we have trouble cooperating with countries that don't share those particular values. We think of them as universal, that everyone, if given the chance to live in a democracy, would willingly choose to do so. But I don't think history suggests that that's the case. There's never been a moment in history when the majority of countries were democratic, or the majority of people in the world were living in a democracy. And finally, I guess my own view is that our efforts to spread the gospel of democracy and freedom around the world, however well-intentioned, have unwittingly helped undermine it here at home. Among other things, it's helped create a big national security state. It distracted American leaders from what was happening to the American middle class, and in ways that helped bring the rise of populism in a variety of ways. I think it has soured many Americans on the ability of our government to deliver successes, because so many of our foreign adventures turned out badly. Remember that when Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, his first foreign policy speech declared that American foreign policy was a complete and total disaster. And he was running against a former Secretary of State in Hillary Clinton, and a lot of people nodded their heads and agreed with that.
And he shouted it out at Jeb Bush too, about his brother's insane war in Iraq.
Exactly. So job number one here is to repair, strengthen, make American democracy look more worthy of emulation than it does right now. And if we do that, then other countries on their own timetables are going to look and see what kind of society we've created and say, well, I'd like something like that for me too. And with our particular values and spin, that's, I think, a much more feasible way of trying to advance the values that we all share rather than trying to impose them or nudge them or encourage them in places where even when the parties involved want to welcome them, it may generate backlashes that are deeply damaging. I believe, for example, most Ukrainians did want to move towards the West, did want to certainly link up economically with the European Union, eventually get into NATO. And the people who were encouraging that thought this would be good for Ukraine and good for the rest of the world. And they didn't think it would be necessarily bad for Russia. But it turns out they were wrong, or at least they miscalculated. We followed that prescription, and one of the results, of course, was a war in which now Ukraine is being damaged more than anyone else.
Steve, you're talking now about opinion politics in the United States, and it fascinates me. The choice between, shall we say, a realist strategy of general restraint and so-called liberal interventionism, with regime change always an option. How is that tension changing, being resolved in some sense after Iraq by the war in Ukraine?
The sort of realism restraint view of the world has been a minority view for a long time, certainly since the Cold War ended. There was a lot of realism in American foreign policy, not always, but a lot of it during the Cold War because, of course, we were facing a great power rival and you had to take that seriously and you had to think in balance of power terms most of the time. After the Soviet Union disappeared, we didn't think we had to be careful anymore. We thought history was running our way. No real adversaries out there. We can impose our will or at least try and nudge history in a direction that we wanted. So you got, by the time Trump shows up, by the time our adventures have crashed and burned in various places, you start to get an emerging body of people talking about a more restrained foreign policy, one that focuses more on balances of power and less on ideological crusading. I think in the short term, the Ukraine war has kind of reversed that process. The defense of liberal values, as you've already alluded to, the number of people who want to frame this as autocracy versus democracy, etc., it's given that view a new lease on life. And certainly the horrible excesses that Russia is engaged in Ukraine is, reinforced a very Manichaean view that, they're bad, we're good kind of thing. But I think over time that will fade. And if you think really long and hard about how you're going to compete with China over time, framing it solely in terms of democracy versus autocracy and not being really careful about setting priorities, deciding what matters and deciding what things are secondary is not going to be a winning strategy. If you're really dealing with a country that's more populist, that's going to have an economy larger than ours, that is working really hard to try and develop technological supremacy in some key areas, you can't indulge in the luxury of social engineering in lots of other parts of the world. You're going to have to make choices. So I think, if you take a more medium to long-term view of this, we're going to see the need for a degree of restraint, different partnerships with other countries, different divisions of labor between us and the Europeans, for example, and a more realistic view or approach to foreign policy than we have followed for the past 20, 25 years.
Read the mind, please, of the blob, as you famously characterized the permanent foreign policy class, Steve Walt. I wonder, listening to their echoes, is there a contingent in the permanent foreign policy class that doesn't want this war in Ukraine to end too quickly? The sense that being anti-war, end it now, is somehow to be against the Ukrainians.
I don't think anyone is consciously hoping to prolong the war, that let's do this because it's so good for our interest. But I do think there is a strand of thought, a pretty influential strand of thought, that insists that Russia must be decisively defeated here. That we can't, just have a compromise peace, for example, because if Russia doesn't really pay a price here, doesn't really suffer, if Putin is not completely humiliated, if not overthrown, he'll try something like this again. They need to be taught a lesson here. I think that's a very risky thing to do when you're dealing with a nuclear armed power. You know, how much humiliation, how much damage can you inflict before they start saying, well, we can put a stop to this, or we can escalate, or we can make you pay a large price too. You, I think, do really want to worry about backing a nuclear armed country into a corner. Moreover, if you think longer term, a humiliated Russia that feels like it is its position is even weaker, even less secure, even more precarious, is a Russia that will, I think, still be looking for opportunities to turn the clock back, to reverse things. What we want here is not a sort of naive peace at any price by any means, but we want a situation where neither Ukraine nor Russia nor anyone else feels like they have to alter the status quo going forward. You know, we don't just want an end to the fighting in Ukraine. We want some kind of an arrangement that makes a round two much less likely in the future, that allows Ukraine to rebuild, that allows Ukraine to be secure, that allows Ukraine to trade with anyone it wants to, etc. But at the same time, does not make Russia feel as though Ukraine is somehow a stalking horse. You know, does not encourage Russia to feel, rightly or wrongly, that Ukraine is a stalking horse and just the next step as part of a larger effort to divide, weaken, eventually overturn the Russian government, etc. That's not, by the way, going to be an easy arrangement to come up with or to negotiate, which is why I don't think the fighting is going to end anytime soon.
I want to give almost the last word about the other country, Russia, to Masha Gessen, who wrote the other day, "The Russian Federation, meaning the post-Soviet Russian state, is a truncated empire waging its last big imperial war, which it will eventually lose. I don't know what kind of devastation it will wreak on the world before it does, but it will lose. It may lose its last great imperial war, the same way Germany lost theirs, after devastating the whole world. When it does, the empire will break up. I think there will be a state of Moscow and a state of St. Petersburg. I think dozens of countries will end up existing on the largest landmass in the world." That's Masha Gessen, who has two passports, American and Russian. What do you think?
I think it's unlikely. It's really impossible to know in advance when a regime is going to collapse internally. And that's because the beliefs of the citizens, and especially their willingness to sort of rise up and try and overturn a government, is private information. It's inside people's heads, and it's really hard for outsiders to discern it in advance, right? We can't get inside the heads of the Russian people to know. Sometimes governments do collapse without a lot of warning. The Velvet Revolutions are a good example of that. At other times, countries you think would have collapsed long ago, like North Korea, seem to go on forever. So I think it's really hard to forecast when this is going to happen. I just add one other point that, you know, if Russia were to come unglued completely, I think the potential for trouble there is enormous. Relations among those constituent parts might be quite conflictive in the short term. And there are all those nuclear weapons scattered around what is now Russia. Who would be controlling them is a real nightmare to contemplate.
Steve Walt, thank you for a lifetime of learning that you share with us.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Always fun talking with you.
Stephen Walt is professor of international relations at Harvard and a non-resident fellow with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. You've just heard another installment of In Search of Monsters, our limited series in collaboration with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Find out more about the Institute at quincyinst.org, where you can also read A Manifesto for Restrainers by Steve Walt. Our show this week was produced by Mary McGrath and Adam Coleman, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a nonprofit collective of smart, independent-minded podcasts. This week, check out The Lonely Palette, the podcast that returns art history to the masses. On the latest episode, host Tamara Abishai explores Juno, the largest classical sculpture in North America, in residence now in a brand new installation at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Tomorrow we'll take you on a breakneck tour of Greco-Roman sculpture and explain why Juno, queen of the Roman gods, mattered in her moment, and why digging up our past matters to understanding our own. Listen at thelonelypalette, 1L2T's.com, hubspokeaudio.org, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Part-time job, forsaken by the HMOs. sucking up the welfare when there's war to subsidize. And it won't just go away if you dismiss. Kill the poor, kill the poor. Put a cap right in their brain. Ain't no room in this utopia for evidence it ain't. Arm the bases, arm the soccer moms. Declare your holy war before the mix claim our inheritance. You better kill the poor. Bad jobs to lands of desolates and despair, with purpose livelihoods for mirrors, pennies on the tear. They ask for more, refer them to the grain berries. There's always room for more in the mass graves. Repave our cities, there's consumerist plantations. Turn the caps into a martial force of occupation. All of America, pristine and sterilized. Woe to those who can't afford the price. Kill the poor, kill the poor. Put a cap right in their brain. Ain't no room in this utopia for evidence it ain't. On the pages, on the soccer moms, declare you hold it.
I think it's Nebraska. It might be Iowa. Red Smear was the name of the band. I don't even know if it's still around. I've fallen out of contact with Matt Grimm. I think it's G-R-I-M-M. And Red Smear is the band. And I don't know if it's still around or not. But thank you to them. And this is Jim Herman, Three Ghosts.
I simply endorse the chemical political agenda. After all I've been through, there's nothing I wouldn't do. You know I'm a great pretender, ain't never gonna surrender. Well, I heard Lenny Bruce was once again on the loose, and then I saw him yesterday. Said it was broken, and he told me a joke before he walked away. Then he turned back around, stood there and frowned. He was looking kind of pained. Said they just didn't get it, they just got upset, didn't listen to what I was saying. I was uncouth, but I was telling the truth. You know, I was bound to fail. I was ahead of my time, but they said it was crime. If you curse or go acting perverse, they're gonna cut you off at the knee. Don't ask them why, just spit in their eye. Make no apology, do what you damn well please. Shock the bourgeoisie. July is a bummer, light up the summer. Play guitar in the new. Clap your hands, get up and dance. We bugger routine and rude. The fix is on, and one big con. If you ain't rich, you're screwed. So sing out a tune, howl at the moon. Show them an attitude. Show them an attitude. Show them an attitude.
Jim Herman and the Hermanators out of Kansas City long ago. They're still around, but the band isn't around. But Jim Herman's around. And some people in Kansas City don't consider him a very good rock and roll band. I don't know. Maybe it's not rock and roll. I don't know what it is, but I sure like it. Jim Herman. He may be gone now. He used to play every once in a while at the community radio whenever they had the fundraisers. The fundraisers would go on, you know, and I don't know how it worked in, but they get bands, local bands, and they come in and play. I think it's a spinoff from Crosstown, but that's old history, old history. And Herman would come in and play, and it was always Jim Herman, and it was always sort of a, what is he going to do? You know, he's a free spirit in that sense about what he does. He cut this next one. I'm going to play one more of mine, and then we'll have to close the show. He told me once that he mixed this one. It was maybe him and one of his sons or maybe one of his friends, but he said it took him like I guess I don't know anything about recording, but he said it was like it took him like 30 hours to mix this. And he said, I can't explain to you why I spent so much time on it, but he mixed this basically all on his own and played most of it all on his own and laid the tracks down. I guess that's how they do it, to use the cliche. And he said he did this all by himself, and he didn't even know why he did it. He said it was just sparked it, you know, because one night he went into the refrigerator at night, and the only thing that was left was a broken ice cream bar.
The kitchen to get myself something to eat. I went down to the kitchen to get myself something to eat. I opened up the fridge and I
Jim Herman. I think he created that after the Herminators broke up. He just made it on his own, basically. That's a lot of work. I'll tell you what. Hey, if you haven't checked out the yesterday's show, Saturday, the Abolitionist Hour, you take a deep dive in history on that. I hope you take the time to listen to it. It was a great show. Deep dive into some history. Many people who I guess would be like 40 years now, 40 years old, probably don't even remember. It's great stuff. I really enjoyed doing the show with Carl G. So we're going to finish up with a bootleg copy. That's right, bootleg copy of a classic. And I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. Really, I really did. The Fugs. The band probably never really existed.
Kill a general in his bed. Overthrow dictators is the red. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can buy a government so cheap? Change a cabinet without a squeak.
Fucking amen.
CIA man. Who can train gorillas by the dozens? Send them out to kill their untrained cousins. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can get a budget that's so great? Who will be the 51st state? Who has got the secret of safest? The one that makes the other service nervous. What's your name, man? CIA man. Who can take the sugar from its sack? Pour in LSD and put it back. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can mind the harbors, Nicaragua? Out hit all the hitmen of Chicago. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who can be so overtly covert? Sometimes even covertly overt. Fucking amen. CIA man. Who's the agency well known to God? The one that got the stab and cut the rod. Fucking amen. CIA man. Fucking amen. CIA man. Fucking amen. CIA man. 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 CIA man.
Yeah.